All right, so we're continuing on with speakers here at YAO 2012. We have Aino.
Yes.
And can you tell Aino Corey?
Yes, well done.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I remember you back from like the YAO days. So you've always sort of been around in these, in helping with these events, the program committee and whatnot. But you also happen to be a computer scientist and a professor. So I kind of wanted to talk to you and a speaker at this talk, at this YAO 2012. So right off the bat, what are you speaking about here?
At this conference,
yes.
I'm speaking about facilitating retrospectives and why the retrospectives that people facilitate don't work, why they get frustrated, and what can be done to improve them.
So when you say retrospectives, what do you mean?
I mean that you take a bunch of people that has done some work together, and uh-huh. then you put them in a room together, and you make them look at what have we actually done, uh-huh. and what were the results of it, what were the consequences of what we did. And maybe they could reflect a bit about what happened so that they can figure out how to change the way they're doing. And in this case, normally when I facilitate retrospectives, it's for IT developers. I also facilitate for people in academia.
Okay.
But that's different things.
Sure. And you also teach computer scientists how to teach computer science.
I do that, yes.
And so what does that mean exactly?
Yes. Yeah. Well, in my latest job, I was employed at the University of Aarhus in Denmark to improve the teaching in computer science.
Mm.
And I was there for a few years. And my problem was that the older professors, they had been teaching for years, and they thought that if people got bad grades, it was because they were stupid. And there was nothing to be done about that. And they didn't have to change the way that they taught.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting, I think. Also because there's actually been a lot of research in teaching, and specifically in teaching science over the last 10 years, that shows how you can, with actually easy means, improve the way that you teach so mm-hmm. that people get motivated. And when they get motivated, they learn. Mm. So anyway, it occurred to me that the only ones who actually would listen when I taught teaching were the PhD students that were working as teaching assistants and that would later work as professors in teaching. And then the normal master's and bachelor students that were doing TA work too, they would listen and they would change the way that they behaved. So I quit the job at university, became self-employed, and now I'm teaching the PhD students and the normal students in teaching.
Excellent. And as you think about computer science, you know, it evolves over time, slowly as it does.
Especially at university.
Yes. And, you know, my question I'm really trying to get out is, what is the right way to teach computer science such that when these kids come out of school, they actually have relevant knowledge? Because they're going to get this very interesting world thrown at them.
That is a very interesting question. So I had been teaching at the university. And historically, what the university taught were people who were supposed to be researchers or professors.
Ah.
And now the university actually take in a lot more people, and a lot of these people, the majority of them, in fact, will not be PhD students or teachers or professors. They'll come out in the real industry doing real work.
Mm-hmm.
And thus the problem is that a lot of the people we have teaching at the university are still teaching things that are very theoretical, very abstract, and very good to know as a background for understanding how a computer works and why a computer program works and how to optimize compilers. And it's really good, all of it. Mm. But it's not all jobs where you need to know how to sort of do inlining to optimize compilers. Sometimes you just need to know how to get things done. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, teaching in books like Michael Nygaard's Release It or books about patterns, I think would be very helpful to put some of that, the craftsmanship into the teaching too.
Absolutely. And so what was your, like, computer science background? Like, what angle did you take?
Oh, I was very confused when I was a student. I did all sorts of things. I did cryptology, I did compiler optimization. I tried HCI, but it was not my thing. I just simply didn't get it. The thing about communicating with people who are not in IT, very difficult for me.
Okay.
So anyway, what I ended up doing in my master's thesis was working with design patterns in object-oriented languages. I looked at different object-oriented languages and saw how the language construct supported it. And then in my PhD, I did three different things. I did something very theoretical about language constructs and design patterns. I did, so how will the Danish industry accept the use of design patterns? So I was out in industry during my PhD to figure out how we could implement it in the industry. Mm. And then I did a third thing. I implemented a semi-automatic documentation tool that would document your programs with design patterns. So it would build an AST for your Java code, and it would simultaneously build an AST for the patterns that you would use, and then it would be connected with the reference attribute grammars, and it would give you a warning if you did something wrong.
Awesome.
Yes, that was fun. But of course, as anything else you do like that, it's never amounted to anything.
But it got you a PhD.
Yeah, definitely.
But still, I mean, that's sort of the sad thing. If you look, you know, what could happen, though, is somebody could come back and find this to use in their own project.
Yes, I have been talking to people who said that I would like to do something like annotating my programs with extra information, so that instead of all this, I mean, nobody wants to write documentation, and nobody is looking at documentation, and documentation gets outdated the moment you've written it, right? Mm. So if the program itself could sort of take care of the documentation, and I know that people say that the code is the documentation and blah, 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 but if it could say, I wrote this code because I wanted it to adhere to these design rules in my design patterns, and then if people tried to break those things later on, they would get a warning. And I had some people who talked about that, and I talked to them about this.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That would be very, very helpful.
Yeah, I think so.
So what is your take on where we're heading as a sort of the industry in general with the, you know, this explosion of JavaScript and the explosion of even programmer anarchy kind of things, where you're building these little loosely coupled services? What's your take on where all this is heading?
Well, I think it's funny because I've been working with these conferences for many years now, yeah. And I sort of see a cycle. It seems like things are going back to what it was before. Mm. I see all this mechanical sympathy, all this interest in hardware, circuits, and stuff like that. It started out being that people had to work as a computer and think like a computer, and then we had the revolution with the object orientation, which was, and then you can debate whether it was true or not, but it would make us design the programs like the way the brain works. So suddenly you would have small talk and things like that would make the computer work more like a human being, or at least understand them. And now we're getting back to accepting that we have to listen to the hardware. We cannot just keep improving the hardware. We have to make our software work with the hardware. So that's a trend that I see that's very interesting.
Absolutely. And you know, and I talked to Dave about this as well. It seems like one of the other trends that has led to this sort of let's go native and go back to the machine is that the further you abstract yourself away from what really a computer is, you know, as a programmer, then you're just in a world of, you know, what are you? You're writing stories. You're writing super high-level code and not really understanding how to exploit the 2 billion transistors underneath you.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the things that I think is sad if that part gets taken out of the education. I think that we have some very short educations in how to become a web programmer and stuff like that, and that's all very well. But I think that people who really understand what is going on beneath mm-hmm. become better at all levels because they have sympathy for it all the way down, mm-hmm. and they know that a change up here might seem simple, but it actually has effects that go all the way down. And I find it interesting that people have sort of a renewed interest of that. I also, in my confused days in university, took VLSI course, and I really found that interesting too.
Absolutely.
But it makes a messy program.
So, I mean, you're having been around the university for a while, and you're still teaching these PhD students and master's degree students how to teach computer science, are you seeing computer science evolve to the extent where, or I should say the computer science programs evolve to the extent where, you know, they're not just teaching Java or Python because professors like Java and Python, but they're actually teaching computer science independent of certain programming language that the university has adopted as the right one to teach concepts? So that's really what I wanted to ask, because it seems odd to me that all of these kids are coming out of college and they're all Java. That's how they learned to program, and they all have this vision of objects and JVM in their heads. So
when I started at the university, I had three different language paradigms in the same year, and it was weird languages that nobody knows about, beta and trine and lambda and stuff like that. They were invented at university for us to learn the paradigm so that we could go out and learn any language in a week.
Nice.
I think that worked really well.
For sure.
Then in the late 90s, suddenly everybody were teaching Java, and I have to admit that I am still teaching Java for first year students. Mm. I'm doing it together with another professor, and he's the one who created this this course, and it's an extremely good course with lots of active learning, lots of clicker questions and lots of activities, and people really learn the basics of programming. I find it sad that most of our courses, at least at our university, are Java. I know that other universities have started adopting other languages like Python and stuff, and it works well for them. So I've had this discussion with him, why does it have to be Java? Couldn't it be something else, or couldn't it be more generic, like the things that I was taught in? And he says the problem is that for Java, it's such an old language, it's very well supported with educational things. It's like Greenfoot and BlueJay, and there's so many examples. If you have a problem in Java, you can Google for it, and you bet there's somebody who's had the same problem.
Okay.
And that's what he says is the reason for us keeping Java.
Hmm.
But I agree, I think it's sad to hear students coming out and saying, I know Java.
Mm-hmm.
Or something else. They should say, I know how to program.
Yes.
And I don't care what language.
Exactly. So, you know, it looks like we always say, use the right tool for the job.
Yep.
But the reality of the situation is that developers just have one or two tools in their tool chest.
That's true, and that's really sad. But we had a lot of polyglot programming the previous years at the conferences, and people are not interested in polyglot programming anymore. And maybe polyglot programming is not the right way to explain it, but people should really think about learning new languages just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
People should think about trying out new technologies just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also some of the things, if we get back to retrospectives, that when I do a retrospective for a group of developers, what comes out often as a result in their reflection is they would like to improve their skills. They just don't seem to be able to take the time for doing it.
Mm.
I mean, if they're single men, then maybe they can do it at night or on weekends. But if they have a family, which most actually do, also in the IT industry now, they don't have time to do it. So so one of the results can be, we need to learn a new language every week. Or at the conference, at the company that I used to work for, Trifork in Denmark, I started a language group where we had every month a presentation on a language, and then we should discuss that language. Did anybody have experiences with that language? What can we do with that language? Maybe not everybody necessarily did to get to program in that language, but it was funny just to do it. And I did a presentation on PHP, and I'd never done any coding in PHP before. I had to prepare for that presentation, but it made me do some PHP, and it made me understand that, for instance, the funny thing is that if you look for a manual on PHP on the net, it will explain to you what an if sentence is.
Mm-hmm.
So that just shows, and that I think was a fun effect, that PHP is also for people who does not have an IT education, because no other language will tell you what it is. They'll just tell you how to implement it.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's...
And this kind of goes back to just talking to Fred George, so people will have watched that interview on here, and his thing of, you know, write small, really small, loosely coupled applications and just ship them. That would be a good way for developers to say, hey, here's a very simple program I'd like you to write in Ruby.
Yeah.
And I know you don't know Ruby, but
yeah,
it's a very simple program. So go do it. You have, you know, 8 hours or a day.
Yeah.
And that will really get people, you know, they have to solve the problem. And after, it's just syntax at the end of the day, right? Semantics.
It is, and the more languages you know, the more it's just syntax. And that actually goes back to the teaching. The motivation is the most important thing to get people to learn anything. It's actually the only thing that can get people to learn anything.
Mm.
Some people have this inner motivation of learning new languages. I know people who learn a new language on their own. Well, choice.
Mm-hmm.
Every month they learn a new language. But some people need that external motivation to get to learn a language. Like as you said, a good example, if you say, make this tiny little program in Ruby or something else, then they get the motivation to do it externally, but...
Totally.
Totally.
I'd like to see, you know, a good way to like write this little teeny program in C++, the language everyone likes to not like.
Yeah.
Especially around here. And You know, and that's understandable given its history and the complexity of the language, whatever. But if you could just distill some essence out of something, a very small application, you'll learn that it doesn't matter.
Yep.
And that actually you might also find a language that really is amazing for that domain, and then you know what to use when you encounter this problem again, blah, blah, blah. Excellent stuff. So you're on the program committee for this event. So let's talk about YAO a little bit. How do you go about sort of figuring out the themes for the event, like what tracks you're going to have and what are the right speakers and stuff like that? So
we tried different approaches. Mm. So one of the things that we tried the most is that we get a bunch of people, experts in IT with a good network from all over the world, and we put them together in a room for a few days and then we brainstorm a whole lot. Mm. Because I can't know all about IT or all about the trends in IT. I know about something and somebody else know about something else. So we get together, we brainstorm, and then we figure out what are the trends, and then we use some dot voting schemas to figure out, all right, we want 15 tracks, or maybe we want one more or one less, and maybe these could be merged and stuff like that. Mm. Another thing that we started doing is that we invite earlier attendees from conferences in specific cities, like in Denmark, in Aarhus, or in London, in England. And then we get people sort of on the floor, the developers that are there in that city, to let us know what do they think, because there's a different flavor to every city, of course.
Okay. Yeah. And one of the things that I've seen in Australia is Australia has a lot of developers, number one. It's a very vibrant community, and they span all platforms, right? From, you know, the Microsoft only houses to the we only ever do open source houses.
Yeah.
And those are the spectrums.
Yeah.
And everything in between. It's a really vibrant community.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they're very stoked about what you guys do for YAO. And then, of course, there's GoTo, which you're also involved with.
Yeah.
Excellent. So finally, you know, what are you going to think about for next time?
The way I'm going to do it is that I'm going to look at how many people went into the different presentations. That's sort of a sign of how many thought they were interested in that subject.
Okay.
I'm going to look at the evaluations to mm-hmm. see whether they were disappointed and try to figure out. Now, I get the red, green, and red, yellow evaluations. That's quick and dirty. It's very quick, but it's also a dirty result. I can't really use the data for much in the long run. Mm. So I really hope that people fill out the evaluations afterwards. So that I can get some specific on why they were disappointed with this speaker or why they thought this was great.
Mm-hmm.
Then I hope that our YAO nights will bring people from different communities in Australia, and we'll get some input from them too about what they want to hear about, because it might not be the same as in San Francisco, it might not be the same as in Zurich.
Mm.
So we hope to get the people that we would like to have at the conference to tell us what they'd like to see, and then we'll do our best to figure out what they want. But I have to say also that we don't always give people what they want. We also make a point of in the program to make committed to give people what we think they should learn about. So we have been squeezing a lot more user interface design, product design into the program over the last years, and also the hardware stuff that people in the brainstorms, they didn't know they wanted that, but they do when it's in the program. And it's good for them.
Excellent. Well, thank you for doing this, and also for teaching teachers how to teach.
Thank you.
Rock and roll. Great to talk to you, Aina.
Great to talk to you, Charles.
Cheers.
Cheers.